This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Raslan, today we have cultural curator, Paramenons, and the owner of Pusaka, CEO, Edin Koo.
Good to be here.
And to have you here. And we also have the return of writer, playwright, and now a student, Anne Lee.
Hello, hello.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
And our three topics this week, I know these people so well and yet I struggle to remember what they do in their normal lives. Our topics this week will be, topic number one is the sudden return of Kuala Lumpur. Topic number two is homosociality. And finally, topic number three is all's fair in love and war. So with topic number one, I'm going to try and get to this as quickly as possible, the sudden return of Kuala Lumpur. I should imagine we all noticed there were some elections recently and things have changed. And I've been doing a wrong thing, which is I've been reading a book, whilst all of this is happening, reading a book about the Russian Revolution. So it's a new history of the Russian Revolution written by Sean McMeekin. It's very good. And, of course, the Russian Revolution was a series of revolutions and ultimately a revolution betrayed. And it fell apart rapidly and became the Soviet Union, which was a horror of its own. And, of course, there are huge differences between Malaysia and Russia. For instance, they had a czar, who's an autocrat, all-powerful czar, whereas we've had institutions and checks and balances, and what we want is just for those to come back. But whilst reading it, you know, I find parallels sometimes unnerving. Like, for instance, the recent Undi Rossa, the Bolsheviks did something very similar called revolutionary defeatism, where, you know, they were encouraging the collapse of the Russian army in the First World War because they thought that would create the right atmosphere for revolution. But another thing which I noticed was that the entire story, the early part of the history of the Russian Revolution, centers completely in the cities and in Petrograd, as it was then called, St. Petersburg. And the rest of the country barely gets a mention. But later on, the Russian Revolution moved into the countryside and it became important. And it made me think, when I'm looking at the pictures and the experience of the elections recently, the pictures seem to are entirely from Kuala Lumpur. And it's been banged into my head for years that Kuala Lumpur, KLites, Klang Valley are not the real Malaysia. The real Malaysia is somewhere else and we should be cognizant of their wants, and that ours are of secondary or no importance. And yet, the dramas of the last week or so have been happening here in KL. And I haven't seen the reaction in from, say, Johor, to a degree, and from Sabah, or from Sabah. And I'm just wondering, has KL come back? Have the cities come back? Or is the real Malaysia somewhere else? I mean, Edin, you...
No, I don't know why we keep having this silly conversation. You know, it's... And this conversation is always kind of brought about by silly KL people sitting here and talking about themselves.
Ah.
You know, a huge wave has happened. One, for example, there was one rather taut incident in Ayeritam, in Yongping, during the recount when Liu Ching Tong was defeated by 365 votes or something. That was the only incident in Malaysia where tear gas was used, I think, because there were protesters.
Mm.
This myth of urban-rural divide is, I think, really outdated because, well, of technology, one thing, because of migration. Families whose children are now working in urban areas who go back with so much information of what is happening. Things are going around in YouTube and through Instagram and things like this. And you go to the deepest heart of Kelantan and places like that. Everybody's on WhatsApp and things like that. I WhatsApp all my people in the deepest remote places in Machang and so on.
Mm.
News of Sabah was spreading like wildfire. So it's, you know, I think people who choose to insulate themselves.
Mm.
Mm. But are you saying like the kampung is like some kind of fallacy?
It's not a fallacy, but I mean, I'm saying that the connections are far more intricate these days. To speak of a urban-rural divide is really not very realistic.
But
in Sarawak, maybe in some real interior regions in Sarawak and Sabah, even here in some places like in Pahang, you get some really interior communities. But even Orang Asli, for example, are very tech-savvy.
Edin, I mean, you say this, but you spent a lot of time in Kelantan and Terengganu. And Kelantan and Terengganu voted very much for PAS.
Yes.
So there is a difference in the mindset between here and KL.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand what the vote for PAS was. Lots of people are coming up with assumptions and some very rude things that are being said about the Kelantanese and people from Terengganu. The vote for PAS was actually a very well thought out and reasoned one. And I hope to write something about this, but there are three major reasons for it. One is PAS grassroots were very unhappy with the cozy nature of the relationship between PAS leadership and Najib, the Najib regime. And essentially, instead of providing a backlash, they decided to up the ante and gave past real power in two states so that that relationship doesn't need to be had anymore. Secondly, it revolves a lot around regionalism and the oil royalty issue. And thirdly, PH had no structure or leadership in those areas.
I don't know when was the last time you were back in your hometown of KK in Sabah?
Sandakan.
Yeah.
About a year.
All right.
Yeah.
But do you feel that KL is its own island?
To a certain extent, sure. And when I go back, I certainly feel more surrounded by family who are much in for the idea for Sabah to be, you know,
You're one of
independent.
Those.
Yeah. Well, no, you know, there are feelings. There's so many deep-seated feelings about how, I mean, much like Terengganu in a way, with the use of resources that were meant for the state but which have been allocated to federal uses instead. KL or Semenanjung still serves, I think, for many as, you know, over there. KL is the capital of over there. But, of course, there have been a lot of changes since Sabah and Sarawak became more important to BN, so that now, whereas before, I would always have come in on my passport and then they'd be like, look at me and sort of, who's this white person? And then look at my passport and see the H and then, oh, okay, Sabah, this strange over there.
Yeah.
They're now I come across Sabahan immigration officers and so forth. So there is much more of a Malaysianization.
Yeah. Well, we must move on, but I'm just wondering very quickly. I mean, my premise, my supposition is that KL, though, is now proud and relevant in a way that it was not before. I think I personally felt very browbeaten over time that whatever we thought or said was just irrelevant. But I kind of feel now, not necessarily it's preemminent, well, but it is relevant on some
but
level.
But, you know, it's what constitutes KL anyway. You know, why was there such a fuss about a weekday being held for the elections? Because lots of people actually are migrants. They come here and they need to go back to vote. And they come from all over the country, including increasingly from Sabah and Sarawak. So that's an indicator that Kuala Lumpur is a lot more of a center now for a whole migratory experience.
Yeah. Okay, well, that one. So topic number two, I want to go on now to Anli and homosociality.
Yeah. Well, I was struck by how, so we see Anwar yesterday finally out and reconciled. And when he joins with one Aziza, there you can hear a lot of journalists and others sort of yelling, you know, hug, chum, kiss. And they oblige. I think Anwar kissed the forehead of Wan Aziza. And apart from the kind of on-display nature of it, I thought the same thing might occur when we see Anwar meet with Mahathir. And I was struck by the fact that it didn't happen, or at least not from what I saw. And it led me to think about this, I think it's since the 1990s, homosocial at least, you know, this idea that is same-sex relations without romantic or sexual dimension, without that dimension. And that this is a hold, still very much a hold on the sort of hegemony of a certain kind of masculinity. And of course, with, you know, I love, we're kind of sidestepping to a certain extent the nature of the crime of, well, it is according to our law books, but that, you know, that is now past us, that we're over that. I'm not sure that we are necessarily. And homosocial is useful, I think, to consider about how we can think about relations between same sex, which don't necessarily lead to sexual, which is, I think, what a lot of people fear. But it's still good for us, I think. There's, of course, the vertical homosocial, which is more about kind of this assumption that it is very much the way that bromances are can be negative in the sense that it's women that are used. You know, you always use your prowess with sex with women as a way to prove that you are not homosexual, God forbid. And likewise, the horizontal homosocial, you're looking at me oddly, Edin.
I'm just a little confused, but I've got a question.
And the horizontal one is actually where you kind of, as I understand it anyway, where you're looking at ways in which hegemony itself can be kind of contested. So hegemony does not stay still in a certain kind. It's also shifting. So how can relations and the idea of kind of, you know, men behaving well or women behaving well be actually more problematized? Can this really be more of a kind of sexuality modic as well?
Okay. Edwin, what's your question?
No, just that initial description. Did you want Anwar and Mahathir to hug?
That's not very Malay.
No, they've also come out of a 20-year war.
Yeah, they had a fractious divorce in their homosocial
gesture when Anwar took Mahathir's, when Anwar placed both his hands on Mahathir's hands was quite revealing to me, because it's very in line with Malay custom that you embrace the hand of the older person. But I don't know what you were hoping for. An embrace? A kiss on both cheeks? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that...
A swirl of music?
Yeah, no, what would it be? Because, of course, but what else... So that's all they could do. They could only hold hands. I mean, we have seen passionate hugs between, say, Palestinian leaders or, you know, other men of Muslim faith who can be a lot more close.
But Arabs are not Malays and Malays are not Arabs. I mean, they're very, very restrained people. But also, you have to bear in mind, they have actually met many times before, just we didn't see it. This is the first public photo opportunity.
After the court.
And you're saying it was just too much of us to ask for a hug, that's not Melayu.
It may have satisfied you, but I mean, you know, people out there would be like, it's just too much, come on.
I've never seen Dr. Mahathir in all the years that I've seen him ever be comfortable with a hug, actually.
Actually, yeah.
I've never seen him. I think maybe he's just that kind of personality, a bit like my father, who just finds it very awkward when somebody hugs him. So I don't know if we are reading too much into it or expecting too much. Or whether the reconciliation between the two of them needs to be so physical, I'm not sure.
My point really is about the question. You know, like you want some sign of warmth between the two of them. Why must it be husband and wife only that we can be expressing something of affection?
Yeah, but then perhaps you're coming at us with a Western cultural hegemonic viewpoint of what it is to express love, if such a word. I mean, that's a very Western word again.
No, I think it's very important to actually, and hit on something very, because... From the body language, how much can you understand about the evolution of this relationship? And I think right now it's really at that respect stage. It's trying to regain the respect, the mutual respect that they perhaps used to have with one another. You can't even go back to that old relationship of father-son, which was very prevalent for decades, actually, between them. The Anwar Mahathir relationship goes back a very long way to the time when Anwar was a student and cyclostyling and distributing the Malay Dilemma. But I think for the moment, and there's so many people are focusing on this in every single interview that Anwar has done so far, already two or three, they're asking about the psychological nature of this relationship.
Mm. And they're both experienced, consummate politicians. And I am sure that as Anwar was in the car driving along and Mahathir was in wherever it was and he was waiting, they were thinking about how should we do this moment and all the subsequent moments that will come later as well. How will we perform this dance about the relationship, strange, enigmatic relationship that we've never seen, the likes of which we've never seen before. So the ongoing homosocial relationship will be interesting to watch. To see how
I just hope that we have arrived at a point, and this is where the nature of the whole fallout, which of course was located in the case that sent him to prison and then subsequently. But I don't know, many of you will know that just a few days before the election, they came out with a recording of Mat Sabu, for example, having a chat with his girlfriend and about G-strings and whatever not. That made no impact whatsoever. So
what was the impact it was meant to have?
Well, meant to destroy him.
To scandalize him, completely scandalize him. It made no impact whatsoever. And he was asked about it. All he said was, I don't know about that recording. And the issue just died. So, you know, are we heading towards a place where these issues surrounding private scandals and private lives can be transcended?
Yeah.
So is that the significance of getting Anwar's entire record expunged from his last? It's expunged, yeah? So it's basically miscarriage of justice and that's it. Is that what we're aspiring to? I hope so.
Yeah, well,
that privacy is privacy.
Yeah. I would say it's actually a return to. Because before Anwar's situation, no one had ever mentioned sex scandals before. But Anne, can I quickly ask, we've been talking about men. What about women? Are there any, you know...
Yeah, you know, homosocial definitely applies to women as well. I think the interesting aspect of, it's not, I mean, it's their relationship in a personal sense, but it's also reflective of how we understood the whole issue of sodomy to happen. It was something that kind of was understood. I mean, sodomy is not just between men, but we kind of thought, we saw it as being that throughout the kind of the first accusations of it and so forth. Last night at the rally of his welcome back, I was reminded of how when it was first announced, I remember, to the shame and all the rest of it, but announcing the sacking of Anwar. But that was
on
8 o'clock.
TV. Yeah, on TV.
That was at 8. At 6, there was actually already, I think it was the Tamil Bulletin, which actually showed Mahathir gesturing with his right hand to try and convey what he thought were the actions that occurred between the Anwar and and the driver or whoever it was at that point.
This was 20 years ago.
Yes, this was 20 years ago. So, and for the first time, we have on our mainstream front pages and everything, discussion around sexual acts, which Anwar called despicable acts at the time. I wasn't ever sure if it was, you know, the accusation of them or the acts themselves. But, you know, it was in a way a very enlightening time. We actually got to speak about these things. And now kind of the sodomy is sort of fading by the wayside, as it might, because, you know, actually we're supposed to be focusing on the travesty of justice that it was. Yeah. But I think that it's important to consider that aspect of homosocial nature, of their relationship that they've had, and that others may have, as, you know, looking up to these people as leaders. I mean, liwat is what? It's a, relatively speaking, it's a misdemeanor. It comes in the scheme of things with a smaller fine and a shorter imprisonment, at least, you know, for Sharia law in KL. But where do we go with that aspect of the dynamic between sexual relations between same sex from here on in, you know? Mm, because it's absolutely a pass and others issue. Easy to go to blame the LGBT and then that's it, you know? Right.
Well, something else to look out for in the future then.
Well, I think it would be used, and I'd be interested to see how it's used in the same way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that bombshell,
stop speaking.
And I'm pleased that you did precisely that. And in a moment, though, we return to Edin Koo's topic here on A Bit of Culture on BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Edin Koo, and Anne Lee. And now, Edin, all's fair in love and war.
Yeah, I've been thinking about reactions on social media and things. I'm very bad with social media, but I follow, you know, Facebook conversations. And there is this issue of gloating that has come to the fore. And it's been centered upon by very pro-Barisan Nasional, really keyboard hacks about the act of gloating among winners in this election. Now, you know, what's very interesting, you brought up the Russian Revolution, and there are so many people talking about revolution. This is not a revolution. It's a kind of spring, and it's a renewal, if anything else, for the very, I think, and this is where we can actually use the term very correctly, the fundamentals are strong. We have institutions, but this kind of verbal bloodletting, Facebook and things, how do we actually regard it? How do we encapsulate it? How do we perceive it? Is it not fair? Is it an act of gloating? Is it payback time? I think we should provide some allowance because for a long period of time, the other side, which really existed on sheer arrogance of power and sought to humiliate just about everybody else, humiliate their intelligence, humiliate their dignity. I really think this entire vote has been a vote back to the idea of maruah, dignity of person, dignity of country. And my concern is whether it will tip over and people will not know where to stop. I think the Prime Minister has provided a very good example of just basically get down to work, while so many supporters around him are still in this party euphoria. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, what's the tipping point? Yeah. When do we actually stop?
Well, first of all, did you ever think you'd find yourself saying, the Prime Minister has made a very good point?
I think we had this conversation just before the elections, and I said it'll happen. I didn't expect it to happen this big. But
I think it's probably, you know, a lot of, you know, naivete happening. I mean, we kind of think now we voted in the angels. The angels have come down. And I think that the sheer magnitude of things that need to be done, the difficult choices that politicians always have to make, we haven't faced that yet. We're still, as we might expect, in this kind of honeymoon period. And some will gloat, but now we're already into Ramadan, so, you know, it's not that that won't be a general feeling, I think, for many. But I think the crux will happen, or something will happen in terms of kind of a shift when, oh, we actually disagree with the angels we've just voted in. Like, seriously disagree. And then welcome to a two-party system and the next phase or whatever cycle of our understanding of how organized politics works.
I'm kind of strangely dreading that moment, but also looking forward to it because it would break that spell and move us on to full democracy, really, where we all participate. And I've been reading these hacks that you've been talking about, Edin, for years. I've been following them, and I have a roster on my Twitter and on my Facebook, and I do read them, and I hate reading them.
You can really use the word scum for these people.
What are they saying? But I'm going to use it. Just to be clear, the gloating, what exactly are they saying?
Right, well, I mean, this is back in the day. But there was a lot of, as Edin describes it, belittling of their opponents. Despite the fact they had all the power, they were very angry.
Yeah, abuse. Very abusive.
Very abusive. They had no charity. And, I mean, their arguments were nonsensical, but that's one thing. And I read them for years, and I was always like, I must delete this one, I must delete this. And I kept going back, and I'd read them more than the people that I liked and admired. So when the shift happened, I suddenly felt, strangely to myself, no desire to gloat. Mm. No desire to make contact with them whatsoever. It was just, it surprised me. And it was like, no, we've just moved on to the real thing. We've actually returned to, Ed, in following up on what you're saying, again, this is not revolutionary. In fact, if anything, it's socially very conservative because we want to...
It's velvet revolution.
Well, we want to claim back the institutions that were there before. We want to go back to the 50s and 60s. So I haven't felt the need myself. I mean, I'm so pleased to see the smugness gone.
I mean, you know, one of the things that really broke things, I think, for this country was the fake news bill. Because so many people really were outraged that the fake news bill was proposed and passed by the fakers themselves. And it was just really an exercise of power. And one of the things that really used to rile me up with these keyboard hacks was basically their pretense to intelligence, that everybody else was stupid. I used to remember this Lim Sian Si being viraled out by their people, explaining the 1MDB paper trail and so on. And this was theoretical economics, which is not different from theoretical physics. In theoretical physics, an elephant can stand on a blade of grass. And this is what essentially this person was trying to do.
But it's made of waves or particles.
Sorry? Yes, yeah. Precisely. But how do you react to a long period when power was seriously abused in the most vulgar ways? And as things begin to open up, I think our realization of what we have lived under for 10 years is really starting to sink in. So how do we respond is basically my question.
Anne?
To all that's fair in love and war?
To this new world.
Well, I was reading a lot of the pundits and analysts about, you know, what the result was going to be. And one of the most interesting ones to me was that a lot of BN voters could not bring themselves to vote for Pakatan, but did not leave the house to vote. This is a very important, you know, it's the interstices that matter to me. So it's like you. I think the assumption that being treated as being stupid is not that big of a crime, actually, because if I know and I'm aware that I am making the decisions, you may think I'm unaware and unable to make those decisions, but I'm very, very sure that all Malaysians were making their own minds up about all kinds of things. But sometimes we got caught in difficult places. So one of those, I think, was around loyalty. You may have loyalty to a party, but not to that particular leader, for example. You may like one part of an argument, but not the entire bit. So how do you do it? Well, a lot of the time you just keep quiet because you maybe need more time to think about it or not. But I think the Fake News Act was really part of a whole sort of slew of things. By that time already, a lot of people are already... I kept hearing the one which is that 1MDB doesn't play in rural areas, you know, that nobody cares. Okay. I just thought, how can that be? That just doesn't make sense. But of course, the usual thing of I care more about the uncovered manholes in my street more than I care about the principle of integrity and whatever. But that's true too. But I think the faith in Malaysians to make up their own minds, I think it was lost in a lot of the discussion, irrespective of what part of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So
well, there was one thing I was saying, and it's been affirmed. You know, I used to get really quite puzzled and baffled. What are they reading and who are they listening to?
Sorry, obviously, they're reading. They who?
They, the government, the previous administration.
Right.
Who were they? Because everybody I was speaking to just had utter loathing for that administration. And they must have been reading the NST with its 28,000 circulation. The NST who were printing things they were telling them to print. And obviously, we now get it from the Ketua Pemuda UMNO that they were really drunk on Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Well, my concern moving forward is that you're asking about, you know, that language back then and the gloating and our responses to it. My fear, my personal fear, is that now I am going to be that person. I am very scared, actually, to speak. I'm very scared to speak on social media. I'm very scared to speak right now in a way that I was never afraid before, because I've never been on the winning side and I've always loathed that superiority based on the closeness to power. And I don't want to be that, but I fear that I could be that.
I think one of the positive things, and this is where I'm quite positive about this whole democratic experiment now, is that we've actually had it for the past 10 years even. And I think we've also been able to construct inbuilt filters. So people are keeping a check on themselves. They're also knowing what to believe, what not to believe. There's also a kind of sensibility that does warn everybody else when people are getting a little too much. I see that happening as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Hopefully that
I
can agree. Be consolidated and, mm-hmm. and harnessed.
Yeah.
I like the idea that people within my family who are not like me, I mean, you know, in terms of I read more in English than any other language, but everybody seems to be, what's the source of that image? Where did it come from?
Yeah,
what, you know,
yeah.
kind of, I'm not simply passing something on. And that kind of criticality, I think, is wonderful. So, you know, thank you, Fake News Act, if that was indeed a kind of symbol of that sort of... Yeah. Vigilance to see, hey, who's saying this actually?
Yeah.
You know, where did this come from before?
I agree entirely. So let's move on though to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I go first, don't I? So my recommendation is, it's actually an old BBC comedy, shot documentary style, and it was created by Armando Iannucci, who also created The Veep on HBO, and it's called The Thick of It. And the reason why I recommend it is very funny, and it's about internal party politics in London, in Westminster. And I recommend it because I think now with this new political landscape that actually we're going to become like that. Now, finally, we can have the kind of conversations that people have. In countries where governments change, each election you can have a new one, you can have coalitions, and people are vying for power. There's a lot of backbiting, backstabbing, utter contempt for each other within your own party, much more than there is contempt for the people in the other party. And it's really good. It's very funny and very well made. It's called The Thick of It. It was done pre-Brexit, so Britain kind of upended itself after that, so maybe it doesn't exist after Brexit. Anne, what's yours?
Well, the day after the results came out, I mean, since I was in Singapore, I had to fly back after I voted, and there was a gathering to celebrate the result among a few Malaysians at a friend's place. As part of the discussion that we were having, the idea came up and was articulated by, you know how ideas build. You can't necessarily pinpoint exactly who said what at what point. But the idea came up to think about the first 100 days and create something artistic that's what would you see? What do you see your new Malaysia to be like? What would you wish? But express it in any kind of creative form and post it and hashtag 100 days after the 100 days and just an on Malaysia day as opposed to Merdeka Day.
Merdeka, what's that?
Good answer. So I just hope it's not just a specific thing that happens within a particular period of time at a particular place. It's something that is on social media, is online, and it can be recorded, but you are encouraged to create something. What is your vision of the new Malaysia? What would you like to say? What would you like to see? And hashtag 100 days.
Okay, 100 days, numerals, 100 days. Okay, all right. Has anyone started this yet?
No, because, sorry, the deadline is 100 days from now, plus, and then the Malaysia day. So I think it's 16th of...
Yeah, you should know
would
that.
Be. No, yeah. no, I mean, the are we still this year? Yeah, of course we are. Yeah.
Okay, all right. 100 days. Edin.
Yeah, I'm still very captivated by the entire Mahathir Anwar dynamic through the decades. So my recommendation really would be to hit the news archives of the 1990s and to really trace the evolution of that relationship, to look at things like Wawasan 2020. Is this a returning prime minister who still has that very much in mind? I was very supportive of it, not as vocal as Anne. But,
it's always the interpretation. Yeah.
No, it's important, I think, to retrace that relationship because it's been seminal to everything over the past 30, 40, 50 years.
Actually, because I know how the relationship kind of ended, but I actually have no idea how it began.
No, but it's more important than that. They actually encapsulate everything post-new economic policy. They were people who defined the new economic policy, and they are now the ones who are forcing that change away from the language, the ideology. It may even be a return to the NEP because, you know, the NEP has never, ever been properly implemented. But we need to get a sense of the history. Mm. You know, as usual, this is a historical moment, but we've lost the history.
We need the historical perspective. Which there is not only one, of course. Yeah.
Okay. So that is trace the relationship or parallel careers of Anwar Ibrahim and Mahathir Mohamad.
Hit the news archives of the 90s. That was the recommendation.
Oh, right. Sorry. Right. Yes, of course. Okay. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. And only remains for me now to thank special honor guest Anne Lee.
Thank you, Cam.
Thank you. When are you back to Singapore to finish your thesis?
I'm in a writing cave at the moment, so I'm not back for a while.
About how much longer do you have?
This time, about a month.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good luck. Good luck. And thank you, Edin Koo.
Next time, I'm providing Ali with the biodata. You've known me 30 years and
you're
still babbling about who I am.
I feel so ashamed. It's terrible. I was really looking up on Wikipedia. But speaking of which, do you have any Pusaka news to share?
Well, it's Ramadan now, but on the 30th of June, we are having a wonderful Ashik performance from Kelantan.
Where will that be?
That will be at Ilham.
Okay, so and you can find out details at the Ilham website and your own?
Yes, yes.
And Pusaka?
Yes.
Okay, see? I still help you out there, even if I don't know what it is you do. And myself, Cam Ruslan, and join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.